Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Strategic Capabilities Office is one of the most lauded organizations in the Defense Department. The office is famous for, in its own words, taking military systems that do one thing and making them do something completely different. And its leader says his office doesn't have to worry about acquisition requirements like the rest of the Pentagon establishment. Federal News Radio Scott Massioni has more.
There's an old saying that goes, almost doesn't cut it. But the Defense Department may be reevaluating that idiom. Stringent acquisition requirements have plagued DoD for a long time. But when technology and programs need to be fluid in the constantly changing threat environment of the 21st century, sometimes almost is good enough. At least Strategic Capabilities Office or SCO Director William Roper seemed to think so, speaking at an Air Force Association event in Arlington, Virginia.
I think, I view SCO as now a 4.5-year-old experiment to build a bypass around the traditional development process. So the one word that we never use in SCO, it takes me a few months to train it out of people who come in from normal acquisition, is we do not use the word requirement. There are none. There are no requirements in SCO other than getting the military ready to win a high-end war. Isn't that, that's the only real requirement, right? All the other numbers that get derived are just ways of instantiating what is that higher calling. And what I think hurts the acquisition process the most is the requirements process. There are other things that could be improved as well, but I think that is the thing that holds us back. I have never been told that a 95% solution isn't good enough. That changing of the requirement is not something that you can do in the normal acquisition process.
The SCO has taken that 95% strategy to heart, and by being okay with just almost, it's been able to save money and time. If a project ends up being much more costly to go from 95% to 100%, then the SCO has the ability to stop at just the 95%. Senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Andrew Hunter, says that's changing the way a DoD can operate against changing threats and giving new life to old programs.
Capabilities Office is leveraging the vast installed base of systems that the department already has fielded, but making tweaks to them or adding some new capabilities that turn something that was, maybe designed to operate in one domain, in the air-to-air domain, and now it's an air-to-maritime system, so it can operate in two domains. It's an air system and a maritime system. But I think what you see with this SCO is a lot of ways to take the installed base of systems that we already have that are sunk costs from an economic perspective and give them new capability. And all of a sudden, very rapidly, we can deploy a capability that, that the enemy may not have anticipated. And we have, in fact, have it in numbers because we're leveraging that installed base.
DoD and Congress have been working together for the past few years to make the acquisition system more effective for the 21st century. Frank Kendall and Ash Carter, both former Undersecretaries of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics, instituted versions of Better Buying Power, a set of reforms within DoD's acquisition system. Once Ash Carter became Defense Secretary in 2015, he created the Third Offset Strategy. That initiative tried to prioritize technologies like artificial intelligence and man-machine learning. Along with that, it set up the rapid capability hubs, like SCO and the Defense Innovation Unit Experimental. Congress seems to be getting that message, too. The 2017 Defense Authorization Bill requires the Defense Acquisition Office to split into two, one side for day-to-day buys and the other for research and development. Roper says that split might be beneficial for the requirements problem.
What there is a chance to also tee up when you're thinking about these organizational reforms are the process reforms under them. And what I hope will happen is that in the R&E function, which should be rapid and agile, that it will see value in not having these firm requirements and doing a lot more prototyping and building, and then determining after you've built, after you've flown, whether you should buy. And by the way, shining example of that for the department is in the Air Force. But back during the X-plane days, that was an awesome period. I kind of wish I'd worked in the department during that time. Right, during the Skunk Works days, building of all the stealth assets, supersonic planes, vertical takeoff and landing, the SR-71, I've been told, hearsay, but I'd have no reason to not believe that I've been told that the requirements for that system were 7 pages, right, instead of thousands that we do now. So that's what I would like to see happen, is more parts of the department embrace prototyping as a way to determine performance, as opposed to analysis and spec writing. Take those years back and prove it on the playing field, not on the chalkboard.
That's something House Armed Services Committee Chairman Mac Thornberry agrees with. Last year, he said he wanted to expand prototyping and experimentation in the Defense Department. Here's Thornberry talking about the importance of prototyping during a speech at the National Press Club last year.
It encourages innovative thinking, not just in developing the technology, but in how you use it. It helps ensure that there is mature technology before you start production, so that you don't have those unexpected surprises. It reduces the odds that you're going to spend a lot of money on a program of record that you then have to cancel and have it all wasted. And if you couple that with open architectures, it helps you upgrade your systems as you go along at a lower cost. Today, it's hard to get money for experimentation without being attached to a program of record. And programs of record seem to be sacrosanct, because once they get started, they hardly ever get stopped. I want to look for ways to foster experimentation and prototyping, both in developing the technology and in their application, and ensure that only mature technology goes into production.
For now, until the acquisition office splits in half, DoD is using SCO and DIUX to change the way acquisition is handled. DIUX spent $36 million last year using a rapid contracting method called Commercial Solutions Openings. The process waives some cost requirements and gives more flexibility to DIUX to negotiate intellectual property rights. SCO has been moving along quickly as well, but most of its projects are still classified. From Washington, Scott Massioni, federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Check out Scott's story and all of our DoD coverage at federalnewsradio.com. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
Join Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller for Ask the CIO, Thursdays at 10 and 2. Hear from your agency's top tech leaders on how they're using technology to change the way you meet your agency's mission. Ask the CIO is a must-listen for anyone who needs to know federal technology policy, implementation, and planning. Ask the CIO, Thursdays at 10 and 2 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Download at any time at federalnewsradio.com. Search Ask CIO.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Democratic senators grilled President Trump's nominee for Secretary of the Air Force over $450,000 in payments she received from Energy Department laboratories. Payments the department's inspector general says weren't properly documented. As Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu reports, senators didn't get much of an explanation for the work Heather Wilson performed, but her confirmation looks likely nonetheless.
The matters in question happened 7 years ago, but several lawmakers said they were relevant because they might shed light on how Wilson would handle contracting and acquisition matters if she were confirmed as Air Force Secretary. According to the IG, contracting officers at Sandia National Laboratory ran afoul of the federal acquisition regulation by not requiring Wilson's firm to document any concrete deliverables in exchange for the $10,000 the government paid her each month for about 50 hours of work. In some cases, the invoices her firm submitted said nothing more than consulting services. Senator Jack Reed is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee.
The IG concluded that you did not comply with this requirement, nor was it enforced by the contracting official involved. And while the contracting official did not enforce the federal acquisition regulation of the contract, were you aware of the requirements to provide evidence supporting your 50 hours of work for $10,000 a month?
Wilson said only that she lived up to the terms of her contract, as written by Sandia, and noted that the IG faulted Sandia, not her firm, for any irregularities in the contracting process.
I did the work. I complied with the contract, and contract negotiated and signed by the laboratories. The review found actually no fault with me. And the DOE auditors never even bothered to talk to me. If they had at the time, I probably would have been able to reconstruct what I did that month.
But Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, was among the senators who looked for an acknowledgement from Wilson that the government should have done more to require some evidence of the work she did or the time she spent.
I'm asking you, as a potential Secretary of the Air Force, whether you will hold contractors to a higher standard than is indicated by this document. It's a forward-looking question. I'm not asking you to reconstruct in your testimony now what you did, but shouldn't we expect more from contractors than this kind of blank invoice?
Senator, I think we should expect contractors to comply with the contracts which they sign with the government. And in this case, I did.
Well, I think you know, the answer to my question is really a simple yes. That's the right answer, don't you think? And there is no way of knowing from this invoice, even vaguely, what you did.
Senator, the people that I worked with were supervising me and knew what I did and that I was doing the work, that they were satisfied enough with to offer me a full-time position as the vice president of the laboratory. I did the work. They were happy with the work. I complied with the contract, and I will expect anyone who has a contract with the United States Air Force to comply with the contract as well.
None of the senators gave any indication that they considered the consulting matter a barrier to her confirmation. But on broader issues of acquisition policy, Senator John McCain, the committee's chairman, told Wilson he expects her to help Congress address what he called a broken acquisition system. He complained that past Pentagon political appointees have shown nothing but resistance to his committee's reform agenda.
One of the reasons why we have not got enough money is because we've wasted it. We've wasted so much, so many billions of dollars, time after time after time. So my strong recommendation to you is that we start firing some people, we start penalizing contractors, we break up this iron triangle of the military-industrial congressional complex.
For her part, Wilson gave only a few clues as to how she'd approach acquisition matters as secretary, though she did seem to indicate agreement with the Senate's push to procure weapons systems more quickly, saying she strongly supports rapid prototyping and experimentation initiatives the Congress has passed in recent years, and not beginning new acquisition programs with overly aggressive requirements.
You know, I think the A-10 was procured in a very tight time frame. The F-16 was certainly tighter than some of the other aircraft that we've built. Getting someone as a program manager and saying, all right, you're going to be in this assignment for 4 years, and here's what we expect you to accomplish. We don't expect miracles. We don't want a 15-year program. We want tight turns, and then we will iterate and innovate after that. I think that's generally been a more effective at getting capability out to the service in a cost-effective way.
On budget matters, Wilson's views were also in line with a relatively hawkish makeup of the committee. She made clear she supports the immediate repeal of the Budget Control Act and advocated for more spending on weapons platforms and personnel, fighter pilots in particular.
The Air Force is too small for what the nation expects of it. Since the Budget Control Act of 2011, the number of airmen has declined, but the demand for air and space power has increased. Leaders of the United States Air Force have testified that less than 50% of the conventional Air Force is ready for all of the missions assigned to them, and I have no reason to doubt that estimate. We are short over 900 fighter pilots, 900 fighter pilots short of the missions that we need to fly and fight. The Air Force is not currently ready to fight against a near-peer competitor. And that should concern all of us.
As to the current year, Wilson said it's imperative that Congress do something in the next month to avert the possibility that the military spends the rest of the fiscal year under a continuing resolution.
And if there is a continuing resolution for this year, we will make all of the problems that we're talking about here so much worse. We will have to stop non-combat flying hours in the Air Force. The pilot exodus would increase. The aircraft won't be going to depot to be maintained. There'd likely be a freeze on civilian hiring. We can't operate this way. We need to get beyond the Budget Control Act and get back to normal operations for budgeting.
Jared Serbu, federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Check out Jared's story at federalnewsradio.com. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
Wednesdays at 11 and 2, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, an illuminating discussion with senior Defense Department managers about how DoD and all the branches meet their mission. From the budget to IT to material to workforce and readiness. On DoD with Jared Serbu, Wednesdays at 11 and 2 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Download it anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search On DoD.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
When the Navy raised up the sunken Civil War Confederate submarine Hunley a few years back, it put a spotlight on the Navy's History and Heritage Command. That was back in 2000, and now there's an update. Joining me with more about the command and the Hunley, Principal Investigator Dr. Robert Neyland. Dr. Neyland, good to have you on.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be on.
So, first of all, tell us where within the Navy hierarchy does the History and Heritage Command live?
Well, we are located physically at the Washington Navy Yard. We're the kind of the one-stop shop for all historical and museum services within the Department of the Navy, and we report to CNO through Director of Navy Staff.
The command then has a pretty broad purview because there are Navy facilities and Navy objects of historical significance probably in every corner of the globe, I would guess.
That's very true. We manage all of the Navy's museums. We manage a large, huge collection of hundreds of thousands of historical artifacts, not talking about archaeological artifacts such as the Hunley, but Navy art, paintings, aircraft, photographs, library. The Navy's library has been around since the early 19th century. It's here at the Washington Navy Yard. So, we provide historical materials and sources and expertise to the Navy and to the public.
And when something is found that actually has sailors and was a war object, like a submarine, and there's probably other ships and submarines that have not yet been recovered.
That's very true. There are quite a number of, especially World War II submarines, that they're still missing on maternal patrol.
My question is, what other elements of the Navy do you interact with at that point at which they are brought up, and there might be human remains and a lot of emotion and a protocol surrounding something like that?
We interact throughout the entire Navy. Obviously, when you have something like human remains, we would work with Navy casualty. We would work with the Defense POW accounting office as well, too. We work with Central Identification Laboratory, which is now also part of that accounting office, DPAA. Our specific responsibilities in underwater archaeology is we manage the Navy's shipwrecks and aircrafts worldwide. And there can be from the period of the Continental Navy in the 18th century, really all the way up to the present. But certainly, some of our two largest areas for losses is the American Civil War and World War II.
So there are some objects that will probably forever remain underwater, but so you make sure that those are not treated in a way that you might, say, have divers just going all through it recreationally.
Well, that's true. We don't, prohibit responsible diving on shipwrecks. But what we do is we discourage disturbance. Since a number of these wrecks are as you've mentioned, are war graves, they still contain the bodies of the sailors and officers that were on the ships. And the same for aircraft as well, too.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Neyland, Principal Investigator on the Hunley with the Naval History and Heritage Command. And let's get an update on the Hunley. This was brought up quite a number of years ago. It's been up, about 17 years now.
Since it was brought up in 2000, there has been several important milestones. The interior of the submarine was excavated. The 8 crew members were recovered, and they were identified through using forensic research, forensic anthropology, and genealogy. They were reburied in 2004 in a cemetery in North Charleston. Since then, the personal effects, the machinery of the submarine, of the tools inside the submarine have all been going through a process of conservation. Even though these things can, when they first brought up, can be appear to be very well preserved, wood preserves well. There was leather from all the shoes and other parts of garments. Sometimes some textile was preserved. Although those things can be preserved, when they're found, they deteriorate very, very rapidly unless they undergo a treatment of conservation to preserve them and to stabilize them. Probably the biggest artifact is the hull itself, and that is still going through conservation process. The riveted wrought iron and cast iron hull components were soaking in salt water for over 100 years. They've absorbed those salts. If these salts are not removed, then the metal will begin to corrode very, very rapidly until it disintegrates. So the process it's undergoing now is to remove those salts. That will take probably a few more years, and then eventually the submarine will be, the parts that have been disassembled will presumably be reassembled, and then it will be put on a final exhibit there in North Charleston, South Carolina.
And when you look at this vessel, I guess it was hand-cranked, the propeller, by the eight men inside of it, do you look at it and say, what were they thinking?
It is pretty amazing, and I think that's one of the things that came out of the discovery of the Hunley in the 90s, is that there was this whole development and research going on in submarine warfare, which is part of mine warfare during the Civil War. And they may have had some of the right ideas about how to operate submarines during the time. There was some experiments with electrochemical batteries, but you just didn't have the technology to really power a submarine with an electrochemical battery. The most tried and stayed manner of operating the submarine was by a hand crank, and you had seven men turning a hand crank, and another man directing the sub. It had ballast tanks so that they could actually, control the depth of the submarine. They could make it slightly positive, and then have dive planes with it. They could deflect, turn down, and so the submarine would dive under the water as well. They looked at different methods of making this an offensive weapon through towing a torpedo or a mine. A black powder charge, and originally that was the plan, to dive under the enemy ship, towing this torpedo, come up the other side, and pull the torpedo into the hull of the enemy and explode it. And then they'd be safely on the opposite side of the explosion. That didn't work well in Charleston Harbor because the currents are somewhat contrary, that the torpedo would sometimes, instead of trailing behind the submarine, would race along beside it and endanger the submarine itself.
Great story. Dr. Robert Neeland is principal investigator on the Hunley with the Naval History and Heritage Command. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
We'll have more information on the Hunley and a link to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.